you for such a kind and generous introduction, and thank you all for coming on such a beautiful evening when there are other tempting things to do. I think, in a sense, all of my writing grows out of one central experience when I was seven, and the experiences surrounding it. And I described it in A Woman in Amber, and I will read that to you. I'll read a short passage about that. My family and I went to Germany in 1944 to escape the Russians who were coming into Latvia for the second time, because the first time they had been there, as you all know, there was the year of terror and deportations and executions, and my father had been on a list to be deported. Our family had deported. Our family had been on a list to be deported, and so we went to Germany, which was really the only place that was accepting refugees at that point. And we ended up in the Russian sector. We ended up where the Russians came in instead of the Americans or the British, which is what everybody who was in Germany hoped. And so one morning, the soldiers, they had separated the men from the women, and all kinds of terrifying things had gone on already, including an execution that we were made to watch. And one morning they took us, all the women and children who were in this basement, they took us outside, and we thought we were going to be executed. But that turned not to be the case. They wanted to show us something and to warn us. And this I think is where my writing comes from, not the academic writing, you know, I mean, not essays about pedagogy, or not necessarily about Doris Lessing, but the other kind of writing. The soldier puts his hands on my neck and demonstrates strangling motions. He barks at my mother to translate. He's finally out of my line of vision, and I can see what is under the tree. Lying on the ground is Heidi, the girl who sits next to me in school. Heidi's face is blue and puffy, but her body looks almost the same. Her feet are bare, and she's wearing no coat, only a short-sleeved dress with tiny sprigs of blue flowers. The bit of petticoat that shows is muddy. Her clothes and hair are soaked. She must have been lying here for a long time. She seems heavier somehow. Next to Heidi is her mother. A rag is tied across her mother's eyes. There's a dark hole in her cheek, and there are two or three dark holes in her chest. She, too, is barefoot. Her dress is pushed up above her hips. There's a dark stain between her legs. My mother is translating. Her voice shakes. He says that if anyone else tries to commit murder or suicide, she will be shot, and that we will all be shot, too. He says that this mother strangled her daughter and then tried to kill herself, but that they stopped her in time. They have shot her as an example, what will happen if anyone else tries it. He says we have to understand that they do not like killing. And I look at the two figures below the oak again. Heidi's eyes are open. She's staring unflinchingly into the rain. Her mother is turned away from her. She would be looking beyond the lake if she were not blinded by the cloth. Mother and daughter are only a few feet away from each other. Their fingers reach towards each other, but they do not touch. We stand watching the rain fall on the corpses. Even the soldiers are silent. My mother leans down and whispers, "Are you all right, precious?" I nod. I would like to tell her I'm not. I would like to ask her when and where I have seen the dead mother and the daughter before. Why do I know that all this has happened before? Why am I certain that it will happen again and again? But I do not say anything. I nod and pretend that I'm all right. I ask my mother to smile, and she does. I pretend that makes me happy. I hold onto her hand. I close my eyes, but the gray cold stays inside me. And one of the most puzzling aspects of this experience, and one that I remembered so vividly. And incidentally, I remembered things that happened in the war instead of forgetting them and then recovering them later, as some people have done through therapy and other, or coincidence or other means. But one of the most puzzling things for me was, why did I have this sense of déjà vu? I didn't know the word then, of course. but there was something so familiar about it, and something that almost, I hesitate to use the word, but something that seemed almost appropriate, almost right, that this is the way it was and that this is the way it was supposed to be. And there wasn't anybody I could really explain it to or ask about that. And, you know, later as a professor of English literature, I thought, well, that was an archetypal image, an image that is lodged in the universal unconscious of mankind, like the hero's journey, or the innocent young maiden, or the trickster, or any number of figures like that, and scenes like that, that what I had seen was something so basic that had happened before and would happen again. And it was this sense of déjà vu that really, underlined in my unconscious that I had to remember it. I knew I had to remember it, and I knew that I had to do something with it, but I didn't know what that was. And this image really encapsulates war, which turns the normal, healthy, productive chain of human events upside down. Generally, parents try, and for the most part, not always, but for the most part, succeed in protecting their children. And here this mother had killed her child, and it was like the ultimate expression of what it is that war means, that it interrupts life and destroys it. Well, having had this experience, of course, made me feel, and the rapes and executions surrounding it too, but this image in particular made me feel so different. It made me feel, as students now say, it made me feel weird. And those of you who have had traumatic experiences, and I believe just about everybody has had or will have before they leave, know how different, how those experiences change us, how everything seems different after that, and that we seem different ourselves, and we seem different from other people, and it's impossible to really explain fully to somebody what has happened to us. And we experience a lot of negative emotions like fear and shame and grief and guilt and anger, and people to whom we try to tell our experience often feel the same emotions, that they would rather not be stopped and told about this dead mother and dead daughter, for example. But life is really wonderful and things change, and eventually my family and I got over to the British sector of Germany, and we were in displaced persons camps. And then I came, as Tom mentioned, I came to the United States at the age of 12, and that was really quite wonderful. I'm very glad that I'm here. And we right away began learning the culture. And my talk is about writing between two cultures and having to learn about living between cultures. And here's, then it's not always so easy to pick up on what's going on. And one of the first things, this Mrs. Chigans in Indianapolis, who had been there 3 months longer than we had been, So she was a real American. She had American clothes and bright red lipstick, and she wore bobby socks stuffed into high heel patent leather shoes. And we were very impressed by her. And she took us out for our first meal in the United States, which was a buffet in a Swedish hotel. And I mean, she explained all kinds of things to us. She pointed out the television set, which wasn't on, but how what sirens meant when you heard them on the street and so forth. And she said, and another thing, she said to me and my sister, don't think you can talk to each other in Latvian, because you can't. They don't like it, the Americans. You always have to speak in English. You are inside the melting pot, she added mysteriously. And then she smiled at us and said, don't worry, you'll learn. It isn't that difficult. They all speak it, don't they? And so she took us up for the meal and to a room with a huge table laden with chicken, sliced ham, hard-boiled eggs, white rolls, applesauce, butter, jam. You can have anything you want and go back as often as you like until you can't eat anything more. In the center of the table is a hollowed melon filled with sliced apples, oranges, strawberries, grapes, more melon. A row of small glass dishes is arranged next to it. Melon, my mother says. Melon, Mrs. Chigon corrects. See, you are speaking English already. We'll come back later after we eat all the other things. There will be enough. But when we come back, the sliced fruit is gone. The melon boat is empty, except for a little liquid in the bottom. Take it easy, Mrs. Chigon says. That's one thing you have to learn how to say, take it easy. She looks around at the room. An elderly couple is silently eating chicken and mashed potatoes at a table by the window. Two full glass dishes of fruit are in front of them waiting for their attention. Mrs. Chigon marches over, picks up the fruit dishes from the startled couple's table, returns and sets them down briskly by her own plate. My mother looks at her uncertainly. Miss Chigon reassures her, in America, you can do anything you want. All you have to do is say, excuse me. Come now, girls, practice it. Say, excuse me. We try to do as she says. And so we certainly tried to learn very hard what this culture was like and what we were expected to do. And as Tom mentioned, I taught myself how to read in English but I had an aide that students this summer won't have. I had Gone with the Wind. Gone with the Wind had been translated into Latvian and published in four separate little volumes. And so Miss Chigons took me to the library, and by saying whoosh, whoosh, she somehow got the librarian to bring a copy of Gone with the Wind. And there's nothing like Gone with the Wind when you're 12, you know. I began by comparing words we only had the first fourth of it in translation, by comparing words and then back and forth and back and forth. And then two of the most, so that by the time I went to school in September, I could read English, but I still had to translate it back to myself, and I didn't have the courage to speak it. But then the two really wonderful events that year were that at one point I understood everything that was being said without translating it to me. It happened around Thanksgiving, and I understood that the pilgrims landed on a rocky shore, and I wasn't translating it back and forth. And then the second time, it was when I finally, and that was towards Easter, when I finally had the courage to actually try saying something in English. And that also was wonderful. So I made very good progress learning America and learning about this culture. And I essentially conducted my life by compartmentalization, which I think is what a lot of immigrants have done and do who have come from difficult situations. And that is to concentrate on what they can do and what they can change and try to keep everything else kind of shut off and in a box apart from that. And for me, what that meant was, because I was good in school, I was, you know, learning and studying and getting straight A's and getting scholarships and getting my 3 degrees. So when I finally came to write, or try to write, I can say something about that later if anybody's interested. It took me 40 years, really, to discover that my life's task was to write about the war and what war meant for women and children and how it could affect mother-daughter relationships. When I finally came to write about the war, I thought I was very well prepared and that I understood this culture, and I thought I understood Latvians because I was one of them. And I was also writing about themes that were universal, the effects of war on children, the relationships between mothers and daughters, the healing power of love and forgiveness. And so I did not anticipate at all the huge divides between readers who have had different experiences to some extent. After A Woman in Amber was published, I got over 300 letters, handwritten, deeply felt, many of them, from various people. And I would say these letters fell into four groups. First, there were American readers who were uniformly positive and compassionate and happy that they had, well, not exactly happy, but glad that they had read the book and that I had written it, and often telling their own stories of trauma or their relationships. A lot of women and some men also related to the book as the child mother story, and how to make peace with a parent who was no longer living, and that closeness that children and parents feel, yet sometimes it doesn't translate into really connecting when they try to speak to each other. Anyway, lots of Americans, and lots of Americans were interested in, you know, what really happens during the war as well. And then the second group were Latvians from Latvia who were also uniformly, at least insofar as they wrote to me or wrote in newspapers or letters to editors and so forth, who were also uniformly pleased and curious and interested, because for them the book explained what had been clouded by propaganda, because the propaganda really about those of us who left Latvia was that we left irresponsibly because we were concerned about keeping our wealth and going off to America and living an easy life and becoming millionaires and so forth. And so for the Latvians, it was like discovering, and I know it's been taught in some Latvian high schools and other places as well, it was like discovering this period in history that really was somewhat different from what they had been, what the official line had been before. And then there were Latvian American readers, my age and younger, who largely were also very positive, especially the younger generation who wrote these touching letters about now I understand why my aunt is so weird, or I was really able to feel what it must have been like for my dad when he was little and scared during the war, that kind of thing. And then there were the older Latvians, and they fell into two groups. I don't know which group was larger, but they were furious with me and very nasty. For reasons, of course, that I can speculate about, but can't know on an individual level at all. Some of the negativity came from a simple misunderstanding about what a memoir is. And from being an unsophisticated reader, in other words, I heard from, and a lot of these people didn't write letters, but I encountered them in when I do a reading or lecture or a presentation. This didn't happen to my family, therefore it cannot be true. It cannot have happened. Another response was a kind of a sense of what literature is or what literature does that may have been more prevalent in the 1920s and the 1930s, but no longer applies in the later 20th century. You know, that you only have to write sweet stories about mothers. And, you know, there's sort of the Hallmark greeting card version. And some of this, I think, some of the negativity there comes from a genuine fear of, well, what would happen if my kids took it into their heads to really describe everything that's happened in this family, or some things that we would rather would not be spoken about. And some were kind of, you know, very... that's not worth going into anyway. And then some of it was from unresolved issues of anti-Semitism for Latvians, because I had written with great sympathy about Anne Frank, and when I spoke to Latvian groups, that often came up about whether did the Jews pay you to write this book on the one hand. And on the other hand, well, I'm glad you really gave it to the Jews. You showed them that, you know, we had a rough time too, etc. You know, so it was a huge surprise to me that was the reaction. And that's not by any means all the older generation. There are a lot of people in the older generation who were very positive, but I was called everything from a traitor to a she-wolf. I rather like the she-wolf. and what that did for me was that I was hurt, I was shocked, I was surprised, but it also enforced my feeling of being an outsider, and being an outsider is not a bad thing for a writer to be. Because writing, because it enables you to be truthful. If you're not constantly constrained about how is this going to look, is anybody going to be upset about this, is anybody going to be hurt about it, so forth. And I think for a serious writer, it's inevitable to be an outsider. That was one result, and then another result, because I had been told so often, well, my family didn't, you know, do this or that or the other. I think the worst sin I committed was that I didn't write about Latvian song festivals. I don't know how many times I have been told that you did not write about Latvian song festivals. And, I mean, the reason I didn't is that I did not live in a Latvian community and I didn't go to Latvian song festivals, and they were not really part of my experience. And even if they had been, I'm not sure they would have fit into the basic narrative, which was this mother-daughter story. But anyway, I kept brooding about memoir and fiction, and noticing again and again and again a couple of patterns. One of them is, and this I'm sure some of you have written something or will write something or give a speech about something, that you will get some negative reaction from your own people. And I think that's almost inevitable. I remember early in the women's movement, you know, the first woman who wrote about lesbianism got far nastier comments from other lesbians than from other people within the women's movement and outside the women's movement. And I think that that's just a pattern that you know, one needs to just say that's just the way it is, and not worry about it. But another thing that so fascinated me was, why have so many memoirs, especially about traumatic events, and especially about the Holocaust, why have so many of them been unmasked as fiction, really? They're published as memoirs and then, you know, well-reviewed, and then a couple of weeks later or a month later or whatever, there's another article in the New York Times that, yes, well, this really isn't what happened to the writer, and there are various reasons given for that. And also about other traumatic events, whether it's about being in a girl in a violent gang, or about drug abuse and being imprisoned, and I'm sure you've heard of a number of those kinds of memoirs, and exactly what is happening with that. Why would a writer who is a talented writer and who could have written a really good novel choose to write a memoir and say, this happened to me, and then get unmasked? Because publication is nothing except saying, well, look at this, you know, everybody pay attention to this. And it's self-destructive and it's puzzling and so forth. And so part of that interest about memoir versus fiction, truth versus lies, this pattern of presenting fiction as memoir, that led to me writing In Love with Jerzy Kosinski. Actually, the novel, Jerzy Kosinski, do you know who he is? Who doesn't know? Oh, okay. I will, since I used to teach. The rest of you will have to forgive me. Jerzy Kosinski came to this country at the age of 19 from Poland. He was Polish. He very bright, very talented, very charismatic, and he very quickly made his way into American society and into the higher echelons of American society, which included marrying a steel heiress who was 18 years older. So he also had a leisured life and a good income. And he published a book in 1962 called The Painted Bird, which is a wonderful novel, but it requires courage to read it. It's about a 7-year-old boy who, during World War II, is separated from his parents, and he endures the war and all the horrors attendant to it by himself in the Polish countryside, and he is abused and humiliated and comes close to dying a number of times. And then at the end of the war, and at the beginning, he is a very sweet, sweet boy. He cries when he sees a horse is being tortured, and he's full of compassion and love. And at the end of the war, he's 12 years old, and he's reunited with his parents, and he feels nothing for them. And he breaks his younger brother's arm. He derails a train and kills a number of innocent people just because somebody has insulted him who may be on the train. In other words, he's become part of the darkness and the horror that war is. And Jerzy Kosinski published this as a novel, and then he immediately started muddying the waters and saying, no, but everything in here really happened to me. And then history, of course, is so interesting. So eventually the Soviet Union came apart, and researchers could freely go to Poland and go to the places where supposedly his family had been, where he had been. And they discovered that he hadn't been separated from his parents. He also said that because of the horror of it, he lost his voice. He hadn't lost his voice. One of the researchers said that he had spent the war eating sausages. Well, that's a little hard to imagine in any stretch of the imagination. It's also foolish, as if eating sausages would make up for living through a war. But also, it turned out, was Jewish, which he had also not revealed. And so then he was unmasked as not having told the truth, and then it turned out that he had paid a lot of editors and unemployed writers to write parts of The Painted Bird. And his other novels, especially Being There, some of you may have seen the Peter Sellers movie of that if you haven't read it. So anyway, and yet he had another story to tell. I mean, he and his family were part of that group of Jews whom we don't think of first off when we think about the Holocaust, and that is people who managed to survive by hiding out in plain sight. And he and his family were in this little village. Anybody could betray them at any time because they all knew that they were Jewish. And so he lived through the war in tremendous fear and anxiety and with conflicts with his family. And yet he chose not to write about that. He chose to do something else entirely. So that's what led to writing In Love with Jerzy Kosinski, and that truth versus lies theme goes through the novel. But it's actually the story, again, of Latvian Americans who settled in the Midwest after World War II. And the basic narrative, the two major narrative threads beyond the truth and lies is the theme of transformation. The major character starts out being really paralyzed and unable to deal with her life very well, and at the end she has gotten some courage and she has become an authentic person and a writer, and so some of that. But I think the major thing is really it's about women's friendships. It's a women's friendship novel. Anna Duya, the major character, has several women friends, and she also has this love affair with a younger man and this terrible husband who's funny, but not really that threatening. But she has several women friends. One of them is Elga, who is older than she is and whom she has known all through the camps in Germany and who has helped her there when she was a girl. And then there is Julie, a young woman with whom she teaches at UW-Whitewater. And then there is Molly, who is Anna's mentor about men, about, you know, Anna gets divorced and she would really like to have another romance. And Molly teaches her how to track men down to their natural habitats, like hardware stores and computer seminars, and how to put an ad in Isthmus, etc., etc. Those of you who know. And but then her most significant friendship is Sarah, who is Jewish and who has survived the Holocaust, like Jerzy Kosinski did, by not being in a concentration camp, and like Roman Polanski, who was just the Swiss government just refused to extradite him, like he did. He also survived outside the concentration camp, and it's the group we don't think of all that often. So anyway, and the novel asks the question with, you know, can we really bond with people and have deep things in common with people who are from other cultures, and can we have compassion for and forgiveness, mutual forgiveness sometimes? And I think my answer in the novel is that yes, and that I hope that tenderness can prevail between people, between different cultures. So I'll stop here because I hope that we can have some discussion and you can say something or ask something or whatever. So. Yes.
Well, I was in New York at about the time when your book came out, and I remember that at that time who was first, you or Salman Rushdie, who had a fatwa issued against you at the time. I really thought that it was, I had the sense that it was from many of the same motives of daring to say even one negative observation about the powers that be that still, you know, obviously don't have much power in any sense of the word anymore.
Good.
We're trying to wield it with desperation at that moment. So anyway, thank you for your book.
Well, thank you for saying that, because it was intense, and sometimes I still run into a person who is so intensely angry. I ran into somebody at the song festival not too long ago who was so angry that I, in Indianapolis, she was so angry that I thought she might hit me, you know, but she didn't, so... Well, thank you. Yeah, it was pretty intense. Yes.
I was going to say, you're probably aware of this. There's another interesting memoir that originates in Latvia. It's the story of this little 6 or 7 year old boy that gets adopted by the Latvian SS as a mascot, and he grows up and he doesn't know what his real origin is. And he goes through all sorts of interesting experiences through the war.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, ultimately makes it to Australia. I think he emigrated there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you're not familiar with it?
I'm not familiar with
it. Oh, it's fascinating. As far as I can tell, it hasn't been disproven. It's all true, but it's really incredible. And then finally, and he does all this research, and then finally I think they determine that his parents were probably executed in some small town in Belarus for being Jewish. And he somehow managed to escape and then instinctively went to the forest where he was living, and then he was picked up by these Latvian SS troops and just taken in. It's really bizarre.
Well, do you know the title?
I don't, unfortunately.
Mark Kurzin is the author. He's now deceased. But the title is just The Mascot.
Please say that again.
Mark Kurzin, his last name is K-U-R-Z-E-M. And the title is The Mascot. It was published a couple of years ago. They also did a piece on 60 Minutes about it, which
That's what I heard.
Quite horrible, in fact, in terms of the history of it. They sort of simplified the history for the American audience.
Yeah.
You have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for telling me about that. I don't, I didn't know about that. I'm going to go and look it up.
I was wondering if you've read the Latvian translation of your book, and if you can
yes.
comment on it as a translation.
Yes, I, Ingun Vetter, and I worked together on it. I mean, she did all the work. I was there in a, I shouldn't really say that. We worked on it together. But I didn't care, and I couldn't care what the book sounded like in another language, because I don't know German that well, or not nearly that well, for example. And so, but I really, really deeply cared how it would read in Latvian. Mm-hmm. And there was originally another translator who, the tone and everything was off, who, you know, translated one chapter, and then she agreed to do it, and I thought she did a really fine job. I spent 2 weeks in Latvia reading the chapters as she got done with them and talking about it and talking about a lot about tone and a lot about connotations of words. So I think she did a fine job. Yeah.
How has the book been received in other translation markets, in Germany?
It made no big waves. Yeah, it just was published. The one in Sweden made it as far as their version of Books on Tape, but no big attention to it. The one that I'm fascinated by but can't tell anything about is the Chinese version. I can't tell what the title is or who the author is, and then there's a photo on the cover that isn't of me, but it's a total mystery.
How about in the other Baltic countries?
Well, it has not been translated into Estonian or Lithuanian. Maybe somebody
may have some volunteers in the
past. Well, I think that would be wonderful if somebody did translate it, but it has not been. And nowadays, I think you need to find a publisher before you undertake such a major task, because it is a lot of work. I certainly learned great respect for translators when I was working on it, and how difficult it is to approximate the feeling and the rhythm. I mean, and Ingvar Bettjer was able to do that successfully in a number of passages, so I thought it was terrific. Yeah.
Yes, I have a question about writing in Latvian and in English. Can you write in Latvian, and what would be the differences for you if you write in one language and another language? Because you are bilingual, as I understand. What differences would you perceive?
Well, thank you for that question. I can sort of write in Latvian. And I have published a couple of little short things, one of them about the Latvian song Put Vejing, which also caused some stir. but anyway, I can sort of write in Latvian, but I went only to the seventh grade in a Latvian school in the camps. Actually, I finished sixth grade, that was it. And so my Latvian is not sophisticated. I couldn't discuss anything complex from the point of view, like if I had to talk about some literary criticism concept. I couldn't do it in Latvian. And I also, at this point, find writing in Latvian harder. But I am more and more interested in speaking it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where I'm going with that, but several of my friendships now consist primarily of the fact that we get together and we speak in Latvian. And I guess that comes from both of my parents are dead, and I used to speak in Latvian with them, and so it's not so natural. But I don't think I could have written A Woman in Amber in Latvian. And also, I didn't want to. I had this sense that I wanted my American friends and colleagues, and that's as far as I thought the book would ever go, to know something about this experience, and that Latvians already knew about the war experience and what had happened to other Latvians in war. So I wasn't aiming for Latvians as an audience. That's a good question. Yes?
I was curious about if you found it challenging to balance your creative life and your academic life. You have such, you have to seem to develop both of those sides, if indeed you want to term the two sides. I don't know how you would see that.
Oh, that's an interesting question, too. Thank you. Well, I really just turned my attention to academics for a long, long time because, well, that's how I was earning my living. And those of you who do academics know that there isn't a great deal of time for other for other things. But then when I started writing, I think it was when I started writing A Woman in Amber, and also some literary essays, I think having been an academic made it somewhat harder for a couple of reasons. One of them is that in academics, in an academic essay or article, I would have to prove that what I was saying was so, instead of relying on what I remembered. And also, I went to undergraduate school and graduate school at a time when the personal was so frowned upon in the academy and so excluded from it. We were not allowed to use the pronoun I in any of our English literature course papers. It didn't matter what we thought or what our opinion was. It was all about, it had to be objective, it had to look as objective as scientific writing. And we also, I think, got a big dose of it was just a different time. There was not much encouragement for people to be creative or to express themselves, and the prevailing kind of attitude about writers was that these were very special, very talented people who had this amazing gift and amazing originality, and the rest of us, we couldn't fly with the eagles. We were something else. So I think another part of the academic and the creative, it's a matter of really so much of time. Because when I have a number of friends who are younger and who are academics now, and they're working just as hard as we had to work, and they have to do their research in the summer, and hopefully that has some, I mean, research can have a creative, and writing academic books does have a creative side, but to turn away from that completely and write only creatively, I think it's very difficult to fit in. So.
Yeah, one reason you're so special is before blogging, obviously. I mean, when it was unique to be a writer.
Yeah.
Now anyone can do it. So
that's right. Yeah. Now anyone can do it, and yeah. So it's been a complete turnaround. It's also, remember, you may have read in Victorian novels, children should be seen but not heard. Well, that's disappeared also.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Betty.
Okay. I just wanted to remark that, as you know, Wallace, my husband, wrote novels as well as being a professor of linguistics here at the university. And none of his creative work did he publish under his own name. His magnum opus, I suppose, is published under Yanis Turbats. It was Tavistel's Turbats. And he had several others that he was working on when he died in 96. But other of his creative work was published under Andres Yerba. Now, don't ask me why. But one of the things that he had totally finished but hasn't been published when he did die was a translation, his own translation into English of his novel, which was roundly discussed as being totally subversive. We couldn't go to Latvia until we were invited, because he would have been put in jail immediately.
Yeah.
But he did this one, and as I read it in manuscript form, a lot of it is footnoted.
Mm.
So he's got about this much of text, this much footnotes. So emeritus professor of German, Walter Schnellendorf, wanted to print it as a side by side, and we couldn't do it because it's too many footnotes in the so-called translation. I'm not assuming that it was a transliteration. And this one, he was thinking about publishing under Baldus Zepps instead of Youngster. So, you know, you get the split personality between the creative and the academic, or what Wallace used to call Meisenstrafts, bread work rather than creative work.
Yeah.
If you comment.
Thank you for that comment. Yeah, that split them and the difficulty to bring the two together. You had a point.
Yeah, I've read the account Woman in Amber, and my question is, did you ever figure out what type of camp you were in, the one that was still run by the Nazis when you started moving westward?
Well, that was, the name of it was Leerte, L-E-H-R-T-E, and I have never gone and looked, actually, because now I understand there's all of the different camps have now been documented with very precise information about when they were in operation, how many people were there, what happened. It was not an extermination camp. It was there were a lot of Polish laborers who had been brought into Germany. There were people who were taken off the trains as refugees who had come in, and it was a concentration camp only in the sense that it brought concentrated people, brought people together. But it had barbed wire and very terrible conditions, but it did not. It was not an extermination camp. And I was shocked. I have such reluctance to go back to Germany anyway. I have not been back. And which is not true for many Latvians. Many Latvians have gone back and have gone to where the camps were, but I have not.
Is this camp still within Germany?
Yeah, Leerte would be, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't know what's there now. But then there's this other place where we stayed named Lobetals, which was a welfare institution run by the Lutheran Church, where we stayed during the war too, and that place is still supposedly there because somebody wrote to me from there. But. Yes.
I was wondering if you would consider your work to be coming from a feminist standpoint, or if you would just write your
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your question.
I was wondering if you would describe your work as coming from like a feminist standpoint, or if that's a word you would use to describe your memoir.
Whether it's feminist? I think yes, in the well, in the very simple sense that women are human beings and that equally significant things happen to women as happen to men. But beyond, beyond that, I don't know particularly whether it is feminist. It may be, because, as you said, it plays against some of the established hierarchies a bit. But I didn't set out writing either A Woman in Amber or In Love with Jerzy Kosinski as a feminist work. I just wanted to tell the stories. And I think that's... In A Woman in Amber, I did have to pick a narrative thread, and I decided to... I'm writing about my father now. But I decided I had to stay with more with my mother, to stay with a mother-daughter story, because it's such a confusing story. There's Latvia, there's Germany, there's the United States, there's the Nazis, and there's the communists, and the Russians, and the Germans, and the Americans. And so, you know, to make it cohere, and also to figure out what to put in and what to leave out, which is a big question when you're writing a memoir or writing about yourself. I did concentrate on the mother-daughter story. So, thank you. Unless there are other questions, do you have a question?
I just have one question.
Yes.
You talked a little bit about your Latvian side and growing up in Latvia, and this is what you're writing about. But you've been here for so long, you teach here, and you do most things in English.
Yes.
So I was wondering if, and the title of your presentation was something about between
two cultures.
Between cultures. And so I was wondering if you, if you're familiar with the third space and Baba's notions of hybridity, and that's what I was thinking about, is about, you know, where do you contextualize yourself? Are you really in like just between the two cultures, or are you in some kind of a third space where you were straddling, or where you are kind of intertwining the two?
I like the third space. I hope that, yeah. I think probably there. Thank you. All right. Thank you all for coming.